welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, our tech expert George Peck gives us practical advice on what to watch for and how to keep our email safe. That's in our upcoming Tech with Peck segment. This is a closer look with the Monitor. I'm Craig Blumenschein from Prairie Public. As North Dakotans prepare for the June primary election, county auditors and election officials are reminding absentee voters to pay close attention to one small but critical detail, their signatures. A recent report from the North Dakota Monitor explains how mismatched or missing signatures can delay or even prevent absentee ballots from being counted. And in just a bit, we'll look at the growing political tensions inside North Dakota's Republican Party as Governor Kelly Armstrong's campaign donations to legislative candidates spark debate over influence, loyalty, and the future direction of state politics. We'll discuss where the line is between political support and pressure, what nearly $200,000 in donations says about intra-party battles in North Dakota, and whether this level of involvement from a governor could shape the next legislative session. We'll visit with Amy Dalrymple, the North Dakota Monitor editor-in-chief, in just a moment. But joining me first is North Dakota Monitor deputy editor Jeff Beach. Jeff, welcome back to A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thanks for having me, Craig.
Set the context of this story for us, Jeff. You were remembering the 2024 canvassing board and the ultimate fact that 452 North Dakota ballots were rejected.
Yes. So after the 2024 general election, I sat in on the Cass County canvassing board. Cass County, of course, the county seat is Fargo, and I'm based in the Fargo area. So I checked out the canvassing board, and one thing I was a little surprised by was how many ballots that they had to go through and kind of examine the signatures, and this multi-person board, I had to kind of vote on whether or not those signatures sufficiently matched. And, sometimes they were way off, not close at all. Sometimes there were, there was a lot of debate about, this J looks like that J or things like that. But ultimately it came down to a vote of these election workers. I was just a little bit surprised. I kind of thought that probably a lot of people don't realize that that is part of the process, and that those signatures can be so critical.
You took us back to a Grand Forks voter who had MS, multiple sclerosis, and then challenged whether the signature should have been counted or not.
Yes. Yeah, so there was a Grand Forks voter that challenged, really, the state of North Dakota at the time did not have a kind of an appeals process for saying, yes, that is my signature, even though they may not look exactly the same. For her, it was a medical condition that made it difficult for her to sign consistently. And that was also at the time of COVID, when just about everybody was essentially voting absentee. And so the election workers had a large, pile of absentee ballots to go through, but there was no established process for what the election workers call curing the signature if there is some sort of question. So yes, it's not a new issue, but I think it's still an issue that a lot of people are probably not aware of how critical it is that your signature is as consistent as possible.
Walk us through, Jeff, the absentee ballot process in North Dakota. Where exactly does the signature, or let's make that plural, come into play?
Yeah, so when you apply for a ballot, you provide your voter information. That information is reviewed to make sure you're an eligible voter. If you're approved, you are sent an absentee ballot in the mail. And once you fill out that ballot, you also sign the envelope that ballot is returned in. The ballot itself goes into a sleeve, kind of a protective sleeve, so that when it that envelope is open. People are not seeing, you know, who you voted for. So that's kind of a part of the another important part of the process. But that signature on the outside of your envelope should match reasonably close to that signature that you put on your absentee ballot application. And if not, if there's some question about it, election workers will contact you with a phone call or an email or both to encourage you to come in and kind of verify that, yes, that is my signature, prove who you are. Yes, that is my signature, and kind of cure your ballot that way to make sure it gets counted.
If you're a couple, don't you dare email or mail your ballot back in your spouse's envelope, because that's not going to work.
Yeah. Yeah. So they have recognized this as a common problem. You know, when those are identified, I think that they are, you know, pointed out to the voters also, so that they can have a chance to rectify that. The canvas, if it does go to the canvassing board can say, okay, you know, it's obvious they just switched envelopes and we can accept those ballots, but that's really, really up to the canvassing board, you know, which is, and the canvassing board and the election workers that open those absentee ballots, you know, they always make sure both parties are represented equally when they are going through those ballots. And so there's, you know, it's set out to be a very fair, even-handed process without, and the people that do it, you know, take it very seriously. I kind of liken it to, you know, being a member of a jury, you know, and people, nobody likes to do jury duty, but, you know, that's a very established American process. You know, we have faith in our jury of peers to do the right thing. I think we have put that same faith in canvassing boards.
So tell us who these people are that are making this initial evaluation. County auditors, is it that's their job? Are there other election workers that are also charged with verifying signatures?
Yeah, so the auditor's office will kind of, as absentee ballots come in, they will, you know, kind of check them off, you know, that to say, yes, we got a ballot from this person that we sent it out to, but they really don't start going through the ballots in Cass County. They don't start until election day. Counties can start going through the ballots the Friday before election day on Tuesday. So depending on how many workers they have available, how many ballots they have to go through, that sort of thing, I guess, you know, it's up to the auditor's discretion as to when they start doing that. But when those ballots, when they start going through those ballots, that's done in pairs with a member of each party, an election worker that's you know, just hired for election duty, and going through those ballots and flagging anything that they think needs further review or contacting the voter to cure those votes, or things that they think need to, and if they're not cured, then they might go to the canvassing board, which meets 13 days after election day.
Enjoying my conversation with Jeff Beach. He's the deputy editor of the North Dakota Monitor. This is A Closer Look with the Monitor. We're talking about how absentee voters are making mistakes in some instances that become critical as to whether their signatures match and ultimately whether their vote is counted. Jeff, North Dakota doesn't require voter registration in the traditional sense. Does that make signature verification at all more complicated compared to other states? It impacted anything at all?
I don't know that it does. I mean, the signature, you know, when you file that absentee ballot application, you have a signature on file. So I don't think a lack of registration makes a huge difference when those signatures are on file with the auditor's offices. You know, I think there is a lot of, you know, it is kind of still a judgment call when looking at signatures too. So you know, it may vary slightly from county to county.
Do we know whether the use of absentee voting, the use of absentee ballots, is increasing here? in North Dakota? Is it getting more popular to vote absentee?
I'm not sure what the numbers are this year. I think they're on par for the 2024 election cycle, at least in Cass County. Of course, it peaked with COVID, but yes, it is. It still remains a very popular form of voting, especially in rural areas where people, you know, might have to commute a ways to get to a polling place. Of course, North Dakota has an older population when voting by mail as a absentee is also popular for those folks.
Are we getting close to deadlines, Jeff, to request an absentee ballot for this election coming in June?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what the deadline is actually, but I think you probably want to get on it if you haven't requested your ballot yet. I mean, we're not that far away from election day, and one change from previous elections is that your absentee ballot has to be at the polling place, or be with the county auditor's office, more accurately, on election day. So previous years, your ballot just had to be postmarked before election day. And if it arrived after election day, it would still be counted, presuming it had the proper postmarks. But this year, they are telling voters, or the North Dakota legislature changed the rule so that you have to have your ballot in on election day. And the Secretary of State does have a ballot tracker service, online service, so you can kind of follow where your ballot is. If it hasn't arrived by election day, you can still go in and vote. The county auditor will accept whichever ballot it gets first.
Do we know whether there are more drop boxes at county auditor's offices available for folks to utilize so they don't have to worry about the mail?
I have not checked on what the status of drop boxes are this year compared to previous years. If you do want to drop, one other change is you can drop off your absentee ballot to a drop box or the county auditor's office on election day. A lot of people had kind of assumed that was the rule previously and then showed up on election day with their absentee ballot only to learn that it couldn't be accepted actually on election day. So that change should simplify some things and avoid some confusion on that front. But all ballots have to get there on election day.
That's Jeff Beach. He's a reporter with the North Dakota Monitor. You can read his full story about absentee ballot signatures at northdakotamonitor.com. It's a website that's free from subscriptions or paywalls. Jeff, thanks again for joining us on A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thanks for having me, Craig.
A Closer Look with the Monitor continues. I'm Craig Blumenschein from Prairie Public, and Amy Dalrymple is the editor-in-chief of the North Dakota Monitor and one of the state's most experienced political journalists. We're going to keep on the election theme here. She's based in Bismarck. She previously served as editor of the Bismarck Tribune and has covered North Dakota politics, energy, and government for more than two decades. Amy, welcome back to A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Hi, Craig. Happy to be here.
Glad that you are with us. Two stories that have surfaced on the North Dakota Monitor talk about Governor Kelly Armstrong and how he's supporting candidates. He's supporting candidates who align with his priorities, it seems, while some Republican lawmakers argue that donations amount to improper influence. Where is the line between legitimate political involvement and a governor exerting too much pressure within his own party? What have you found?
Yeah, well, I think there's differences of opinion on that. Governor Armstrong has gotten involved in donating contributions to legislators and also statewide candidates in the Republican primary. He's also been very out front with some ads where he's been meeting with some of the, you know, he's shown with some of the legislative candidates that he favors. Back in 2022, when Governor Burgum was spending money on some campaigns, except Governor Burgum went at it a little bit differently than Governor Armstrong is, but we have seen before governors get involved making donations. I think previous governors also made donations, but perhaps were a little quieter about it. Maybe we didn't see them in the ads. So it might be a little bit more visible that people are noticing. And it is getting criticism from some folks, particularly Republican lawmakers and Republican candidates who have the endorsement of their district, and they feel it's not proper for the governor to be campaigning for candidates who are not endorsed by their district. So that's kind of the discussion, but we did hear some similar criticism of Governor Burgum from some of the same folks back in 2022. Another difference we're seeing this primary is that we have so many contested races and so many Republicans running for office, and that may be another reason that we're seeing more involvement from the governor and others who are participating in campaign donations.
Amy, campaign finance reports show that the governor contributed about $200,000 to allies and favored candidates in legislative and statewide races. What does this tell us about the growing importance of intra-party battles in North Dakota politics, especially in a state that's dominated by his party, the Republicans?
Yeah, it's been a very different campaign season because of that split in the party. We're seeing the candidates who are endorsed by the party for public service commission, those are not the incumbents. And that's kind of a departure from, you know, maybe what had happened in years past. And so the governor is supporting the incumbents with his donations. So I think you're seeing a divide with the governor supporting some of the more traditional incumbents while the party has endorsed some more newcomers or some more populist candidates.
Critics say, of course, that these donations could discourage independent thinking among lawmakers. And supporters argue that governors have always tried to build legislative coalitions. Is this unusual to the level and direct involvement by a North Dakota governor that we've seen? And what impact do you think it might have in the next legislative session?
Well, the governor said that the donations came with no strings attached, no expectations. I think critics would say that maybe there's some kind of implicit expectation that goes along with it. So I think there's a difference of opinion there. And I guess we'll see what happens in the legislative session if there is any influence that's exerted there. As I said earlier, I'm not sure that it's unusual to see the governor get involved, but it might be just a little bit more visible, especially when you see those ads and it's very clear that the governor has favored candidates.
Enjoying my conversation with Amy Dalrymple. She's the editor-in-chief of the North Dakota Monitor. Amy, what else is the Monitor up to?
Yeah, well, we've been working on several stories about candidates running for statewide office, and we've been focused on the races that are contested in the June primary. Last week, we had a three-part series that looked at the candidates for Public Service Commission. We wanted to report on the candidates' views related to CO2 pipelines, which, of course, has been a controversial topic in North Dakota, and that's the reason that one of the new candidates entered the race. We also highlighted the PSC, their views on data centers, which are a hot topic in North Dakota, and also what they would do to keep electricity affordable. One recent story that we covered related to the U.S. House candidates talked about their views on mail-in voting and elections. We've also reported on their views on the war in Iran, and our next story will be on their views on immigration enforcement.
And Mary Stoyer is also working on a story about the candidates for superintendent of public instruction.
Yeah, that story will be out this week. It's about what the three candidates view on what the state could do better to improve teacher recruitment and retention.
You can find all of the coverage at NorthDakotaMonitor.com. Their election coverage will be highlighted in the upper right corner of their website. And of course, you can sign up for their free newsletter. All of their reporting is free from subscriptions, free from paywalls. Amy Dalrymple, she's the editor-in-chief of the North Dakota Monitor. Amy, thanks for joining us on A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thanks for having me, Craig.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Jill Freitas. Jasmine High Eagle is the secretary for the Nez Perce Fish and Wildlife Commission and has spent her life fishing on Nez Perce lands. Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke to High Eagle about how the changing climate is impacting fish and water.
Growing up Nimiipuu, what are some of your earliest memories of fishing, and who taught you the importance of being on the river?
I was a big daddy's girl. Everything my dad did was what I wanted to do. When we would go fishing, whether that was dip netting or it was hook and line or gaffing, like my dad would do that, right? But we all did it. All us girls would do it too. But when we went to like driving, like I remember we were like at Looking Glass and dip netting and learning those roads, and I used to always be amazed how my dad could just like drive all these places, right? And without a Google map, without our maps or whatever. But the feeling, right? That feeling and that connection to the salmon and when you catch, you know, it's kind of indescribable to be able to do that. And there's this feeling like you know right when you're going to catch one. My earliest memory for like the Columbia River going down there in my adult years, I remember going down there, and that's like a totally different water from our water, you know, from our tributaries that are up here in Idaho, Washington. Like being told to respect it, you know, to not fear it, which resonated with me because like my dad would always leave offerings, you know, my dad would always, you know, we don't just are taking, you know, what we need. But I remember having to watch that water, learn that water, like build that relationship with that water to understand like how those eddies are moving and how the water is going. And I remember holding onto ropes, and I remember just watching the water. I was told just to watch the water, sit with the water.
And I wanted to ask, you know, what does fishing represent or mean to you beyond food, you know, like culturally or as a way of staying connected to your family and identity?
It is relationship, responsibility, connection. It is returning to our lands, our waters, reconnecting with our relatives, you know, and our teachings, our identity. Like, I'm so grateful to be Nimiipuu, so grateful to be Nimiipuu, because I feel like when I'm on the river, I always say like my cup is being filled, because like the healing that the salmon and the water and the land brings to me, like, is not measurable, you know, because I really do feel like that connection to like our past, to, you know, for like generations, like who stood in those same places, you know, like I shared being in that, recognizing like I've been here before, but also like while you're with your relatives.
And, you know, salmon have always been central to Nimiipuu culture, you know, way of life. Over the years, you know, what changes have you noticed in the river itself? And what concerns do you have when you look at today's salmon populations for the younger generations?
I feel like the biggest changes have been the size of the salmon runs, the size of the salmon, the water levels, the overall health of the river, invasive species, excessive algae that we call it muck, the muck buildup, right? And then like the polluted bank and shorelines, the increasing like the temperature of the water too. You know, the temperature of the water is a lot warmer. You know, it's the pollution, changing of the seasons in when the fish are running. My daughter, we were having a conversation and we talking salmon, talking hasu, right? Talking for like all our water relatives. What she shared with me, you know, is super important. She's like, Mom, I don't want to be a grandma or a mother that is only talking about the memories of our salmon. I don't want to be sharing how beautiful our salmon was, how beautiful our trips were, how beautiful the land and the water was. And that's the reality of what it could be. Like, that really is a reality. From the climate change, I was just at the Columbia River this last weekend, and like, it really does it. Like, it chokes me up and it brings me to tears thinking like, I'm going to take in this moment and I'm going to be very grateful for where I'm at right now and this opportunity, because just like us, it's not promised tomorrow, you know, it's not promised tomorrow. And like for our relative, the salmon, like, isn't promised tomorrow. And that breaks my heart. Like, it breaks my heart because our salmon, you know, like, they aren't only like a food for us, you know, they are really a part of our identity. And I'm trying to instill that, you know, with my children, but also with anybody that's willing to participate, willing to learn, you know, because it really is that survival and that generations. That's that sustenance that has been taking care of us from time immemorial.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Jill Freitas for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Still ahead on this Thursday's Main Street, practical advice from our tech expert George Peck on how to keep your email safe. That's right after this. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Email remains one of the most common ways criminals try to steal passwords, money, and personal information, from phishing scams and fake package notifications to dangerous attachments and spoofed websites. Inbox threats continue to evolve. And in this week's edition of Tech with Peck, technology expert George Peck joins us with practical advice on recognizing spam, protecting our accounts, and avoiding the mistakes scammers hope we make. George, have you ever been scammed in an email?
I have not, but I'm going to diverge right away and go back to something that we've been bantying about
okay.
for weeks.
Okay.
Okay, here it is. It is 10 to the power of 100. Okay, that's a 1 followed by 100 zeros. I had it wrong, and I think we edited out the wrongness. Thank you. Thank you for editing out my folly. This is the Google, that is G-O-O-G-O-L, the number, which the search engine and all the things we've talked about kind of followed onto. But we wanted to set that straight. Now, here's an interesting thing, and I'm going to thank Wikipedia for this. The term was coined Google, G-O-O-G-O-L, in 1920 by a nine-year-old guy named Milton Serrata, who was the nephew of a mathematician named Edward Kasner. Fast forward to 2024, and the Kasner family or estate contemplated suing the search engine company and decided against it. But there is the real history and the final definitive, thanks to Wikipedia, which I think is more of an authority than Reddit, of the Google. 100 zeros, that is 10 to the power of 100. A slightly larger number than the CEO of the company I work for makes, but not much.
All right.
All right,
now,
there you
go. Of course,
go.
Google has Gmail, and that's probably maybe the most popular email system in the world. George, that's what I use for all of my accounts. I don't use any other product currently other than Gmail, but goes back to my first question. Do you think you've ever been scammed via email?
I have never been scammed, but it's been tried many a time. And email, and I think probably an equal threat now is texting. So we think of two primary approaches: phishing, P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G, which is kind of the email approach. Smishing is the SMS. Simple messaging service,
yeah,
which is the text,
exactly.
The text standard. So the most fascinating one is I didn't get scammed, but I got into a conversation with a hacker one day. Usually they're long gone by the time you fall into their attempted trap, but it's a good story. I got an email from the estimator for a painting company that had painted our house. And they had painted our house probably 2 years prior, so there was really no reason for me to hear from the estimator. Maybe I would have heard from a salesperson trying to see, if I needed touch-ups or if I needed, interior paint. But it was the estimator. And it was simply an email that said, please sign this document. And it was a link to DocuSign or some of the document services that host legitimate online documents. I didn't understand why I was hearing from this guy. And typically, when a hacker takes over an email account, they take it over, they send their phishing campaign, and they go on. I mean, they're going to do it for 100 accounts that hour or that day, and they are not going to stick around and see if anybody emails back. And the person they hack still has an active email account and can get the messages. So I emailed back, assuming I was emailing the estimator, and saying, I don't know why you're sending this to me. You might have been hacked. You might want to change your password, but I don't know why I would need to sign this. I immediately got an answer that was very nondescript, not sorry about this. We got hacked, or no, this is something that actually was a follow-up from your contract from two. It was just sign this document. It's important. That's all it was. And I said, I don't know why I would sign this. I'm not sure I'm even talking. Just the guy, I'm assuming it was a guy. Most criminals are guys.
So, I think that's probably true.
All right. So I emailed back and said, this is probably not. He's just signed the document. It's important. So I called the office and I said, I got this email from the estimator. Yeah, he got hacked. Don't answer it. We're changing the password. So I did take the opportunity to email one more time and say, enjoy it while you can, do it. I called the office and the password's going to be changed in 2 minutes. So I had a conversation with a hacker, and that was fairly rare. but the occurrence was very common when you are receiving an email from a known, trusted colleague, friend, vendor with a request to sign something, log into something, verify something. And you got to be really careful because in many cases they are very legit. They're coming from known email addresses. And you got to be really careful because in many cases they are just phishing for your personal information. The most valuable thing they can get from you is maybe a bank account number, a password, email address and password. As soon as they have that, they can then log into your account and do the same thing. Be really careful with emails to start.
And these phishing opportunities look real. They feel real. They look better these days. And I think, yes, we all have to consider them red flags. My policy is if I get an email that I recognize, but wonder about it, I'll call the people right away and say, did you send this email or not? And they'll tell me no or yes that they did. And here's why you got this. And on we go. George, so we know what phishing is now. What is spam?
The fine term was unsolicited commercial email, UCE. Spam can have phishing with it, and it often does. But spam is much more along the lines of, you know, buy this product, too good to be true offers, you've won something. That's kind of a phishing, you know, scam typically. But spam, my favorite spams for a while were what were called pump and dump stock spams, where someone was either short selling or trying to, you know, buy a stock and keep it, a day trader was, and they would send out 1,000 emails, well, maybe 100,000 emails. You got to buy this stock today before, you know. So just bogus, you know, commercial email for very questionable products. If I got one, you know, renewal by Anderson Windows spam, I've gotten a million of them. There's certain products, certain companies that for some reason just become spam magnets.
I'm looking at my spam file, George, and I'm looking at spams from IBM. How interesting. Really didn't even realize they were in the personal computer game anymore. I see this is funny. A tech expert, George, is in my spam folder. I see books. I see follow-ups for Main Street in my spam folder. And I see things to buy in my spam folder as we're looking today. So everyone has a spam folder. I rarely, if ever, look at mine. I ignore it. Is that good advice, George?
It usually is. The problem is that no matter how good the spam filter, it occasionally catches real email. So that's called a false positive. It occasionally lets through a spam. That's a false negative. But the very common problem is I sent you an email. Did you get it? No. We'll go check your spam folder and occasionally I'll find it in there. So depending on how the email is formatted, worded, it may be legit, but the spam filter may catch it as a false negative. So occasionally you got to go dig through your spam folder and see if there's something real in there. I occasionally do go through my spam folder just every once in a while. I'll look through a week or 10 days of spams and occasionally find something in there that was legit, and I'll mark it as not spam so the filter will try not to catch it next time.
George, you mentioned earlier texting, SMS messages that are looking for our personal information. So let us know how those work. They often have links to websites.
So there's two, I think, primary ones that I'm seeing, or three. The one I remember first, which was very interesting, was one saying, your shipment has been delayed. Click here to get your shipment processed. And when I look at links in spams or in SMS messages or anywhere that are suspicious, in many cases, you can look at the link. You can copy it to your clipboard and just paste it into a text editor, but be careful. Right-click on it and copy it. Don't click through to it. If you look at the entire URL, in many cases, your email address will be part of it as a parameter so that when you click through, the spammer can see who clicked through. And those are bad. All right. So what I will do in those cases is I will take that URL and just strip the email part off. And then just for fun, execute it because there's no personal information going along with the email. In this case, it was a web page that looked like a FedEx tracking history. left this, and the target location where you should receive your package is Fort Collins, Colorado. Well, I didn't put my email address in there, but I live in Fort Collins, Colorado. How did this guy, because most criminals are guys, figure this out? So there's very interesting ways. The IP address that your internet service provider gives you, in many cases, tags your location. So had I been in a different city on a different IP address, and just for fun, I got on my cell phone and went to the same exact URL and got like Sioux City, Iowa, wherever the cell provider's IP address happened to be tagged that day. So there are very ingenious ways that people try to trick you. And I'm assuming, I didn't go any farther, but I'm assuming if I clicked through eventually to that SMS message, I would have gotten the following. In order to receive your package, you need to add an additional shipping fee of $19.99. Click here with your credit card.
Yeah.
So it's always something to trick you into either providing personal information, eventually providing money. The other favorites, and we've all gotten these now, this is the Colorado DMV with the last notice of your violation.
You speeder, George?
Click here to pay your speeding ticket. Well, I don't have a speeding ticket. And if I did have a speeding ticket, the Colorado State Patrol doesn't have my cell number, and they don't ask for speeding ticket money via texts.
Sure.
So they sound very frightening, and they, you know, they can look legitimate. You got to be careful. I also got the voicemail with the accent. This is the ILS. It's like, I'm not going to, you know, no, I don't. And then the really weird ones are you coming to the party tonight? I didn't hear from you. Hmm. You just get these random texts that seem innocent. They're not asking for
hello,
personal information.
Are you there?
Yeah, are you there?
Yeah.
You know, something. And I have not pursued these, but understanding is the idea is that we now want to engage you in a conversation.
Sure.
And we go through a very involved process of building rapport and eventually taking something from you, personal information, money.
Advantage.
I got one more because it was very frightening. You probably knew who this person was. It was my father's girlfriend. And she got a call. This was not text. It was a phone call from a grandson who was in Canada and needed money to come home. And it sounded just like him was the term she used. It sounded just like him. And he needed money sent to a Western Union address, and she did it. And it was not her grandson, and the money was very gone. So it's just, there's so many bad actors.
Yeah.
And you got to be careful because it's so easy to go to prairiepublic.org and copy that image. And an email doesn't enforce a from address. The from address can come from, you know, hello@prairiepublic.org with the Prairie Public logo.
I'm a programmer. You can make that say
anything
you want. Oh,
man, it's so easy to do. So just be careful.
George, one other scheme that I've seen is on a very official looking email that said essentially, hey, never reply to the email. Call us and we'll verify it for you. Here's our number. Don't reply to this email because that's not the way we do business. Call us. And of course, it's not their number.
I got one other one. And this one is this. You got to be careful. Letting you know that you purchased another year of Norton Utilities or some, you know, spam filter. If you didn't do this, call this number. So, no, I didn't buy a year of this, but you call the number. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Peck. If you give us your credit card number, we'll refund that for you.
Right.
Okay, it's just be careful.
Just to be able to refund that from their end without anything from you.
Yeah, it's just be careful.
Because you can lose maybe 10 to the 100th number of zeros.
You can lose a Google. You can lose a Google from Google.
George Peck joins us on Thursday here on Main Street, Tech with Peck. George, great to visit with you.
It's fun. See you next week.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for The Middle Live. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
A data center turns water brown. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
A new data center in Morgan County, Georgia, constructed by Meta, is allegedly turning the drinking water of nearby residents brown.
During a congressional hearing last week, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez displayed a jar of turbid water to Jessica Kramer, the Assistant Administrator for Water at the EPA.
AOC said the sample was collected after the center was built, and the only change was the facility's construction.
She added that data centers were forcing people to drink bottled water. She implied the facilities were also causing appliances to stop working and decreasing water pressure. After questioning at the hearing, the EPA official said she would investigate the issue.
Concerns about data centers and their immense demand for water have been occurring for some time. Many of the facilities use water to cool their hot processors.
The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists reports that in Northern Virginia, data centers consumed almost 2 billion gallons of water in 2023, which was an increase of 63% in 4 years.
According to the online publication Visual Capitalist, as of April this year, Georgia was the third highest state in the U.S. for the number of existing and planned data centers, with Texas number one and Virginia number two.
There's growing opposition around the country to data centers. A recent Gallup poll showed more than two-thirds of adults opposed construction of the huge complexes, and a majority said they'd rather have a nuclear power plant in their backyard.
Last month in Maine, the legislature passed a bill placing a moratorium on new facilities, but Governor Janet Mills vetoed it. Now, local officials in that state are considering their own measures to investigate the impacts.
Last week, the city council in Denver, Colorado, unanimously passed an ordinance to halt data center development for 1 year, and some officials wanted to ban them altogether.
In addition to water problems, these facilities can affect air. A new study published last week shows that the heat data centers emit can increase air temperatures in nearby downwind neighborhoods by up to 4 degrees Fahrenheit.
Researchers from Arizona State University measured heat pollution from data centers in Mesa and Chandler, Arizona, and concluded that the impact extended about one-third of a mile from each facility.
Those findings are supported by other research that shows data centers are warming the land around them, in some cases by up to 16 degrees Fahrenheit.
All of this news comes as the Trump administration is making efforts to allow data center developers to begin pre-construction activities even before they receive final environmental permits.
Sea levels around the world are rising because of human-driven climate change. But exactly where the water is coming from has been a stubborn mystery.
Until now, a new study has determined that warming ocean water is the leading cause of rising sea levels, accounting for 43% of the increase since 1960. That's due to a process called thermospheric expansion, where seawater expands as it absorbs heat from the atmosphere and takes up more space.
Melting ice and glaciers contributed to the rest of sea level rise, with mountain glaciers accounting for 27%, the Greenland ice sheet 15%, and Antarctic ice sheet 12%.
A more troubling finding of the international study led by researchers in China was the determination that sea level rise is accelerating every year. It was 2 millimeters per year averaged between 1960 and 2023, but doubled between 2005 and 2023. So sea levels aren't just rising, they're rising faster than they were just a couple of decades ago.
Unfortunately, the team says that even if greenhouse gas emissions were slashed today, the large inertia of the ocean and the world's ice would push sea levels higher for centuries to come.
And finally, it's nearly summer and you'll want to lather on the sunscreen before heading outside, but many sunscreens carry an environmental cost, harming marine organisms or being derived from fossil fuels.
What to do? Do what fish do. Ever seen one with a sunburn?
No, no you haven't. That's because many fish make their own natural sunscreen with a UV protective compound called Gadusol. The compound is found in the eggs of several fish species, such as cod, salmon, and zebrafish, but is otherwise rare in nature.
So even though Gadusol was discovered over 40 years ago, it's never been brought to market as a sunscreen because it would be difficult to extract in a scalable and environmentally sound way.
But researchers in China have been able to use E. coli bacteria as mini biological factories to synthesize Gadusol from zebrafish. In experiments, their process increased the yield by nearly 93 times.
In an interesting twist, they found Gadusol showed antioxidant activity comparable to that of vitamin C, which helps to neutralize the damage UV exposure causes cells. So one day their method could be a green and sustainable way to both protect and repair skin, and that would be no laughing matter.
That's it for this week in water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 28th. Every year, dozens of communities from across the country compete for the prestigious All-America City Award, presented by the National Civic League. The National Civic League, a nonpartisan nonprofit founded in 1894, bestows the award on 10 communities each year that exemplify the American democratic ideal of a civil society, where citizens work together in the pursuit of the common good. The contest began in 1949, inspired by the long-standing tradition of naming an All-American football team. Fargo proudly claimed the All-America City Award in 1959. Moorhead earned an honorable mention in 1977 and later became a finalist in 1978, 1998, and 1999. Then, in 2000, the two cities set aside their friendly rivalry and did something they had never done before. They applied together. The gamble paid off, and the Fargo-Moorhead metro area earned a spot among 30 finalists. On this date, in the year 2000, a 46-member delegation from both cities was making their final preparations before departing for Louisville to make their case before the National Civic League. Each finalist had just 10 minutes to present and 10 minutes for questions, a tight window to stand out among 29 other communities from 17 states. The Fargo-Moorhead team took the stage with purpose, opening with a unified chant, "We are more than you expect." They built their case around three community-driven initiatives. Project Tomorrow brought together 200 diverse stakeholders to envision what Fargo-Moorhead could become by 2010 and chart a course to get there. The Cultural Diversity Project worked to deepen awareness and appreciation of diversity while providing meaningful support to minority residents, including the many refugees who had made Fargo-Moorhead the nation's fourth largest resettlement destination at the time. America's Promise invested in young people by connecting them with caring adults, providing safe spaces for structured activities, equipping them with marketable skills through education, and opening doors to community service. The strength of those grassroots initiatives resonated with the judges, and Fargo-Moorhead was named one of the 10 All-American City Award winners for 2000. It was a fitting tribute to two cities that, for all their friendly rivalry, have long known how to work together to improve life across the metro. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Trista Razor Sturza. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by the Study ND, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Thursday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Coming up Monday on the show, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein in our Philosophical Current segment explores how artificial intelligence is reshaping higher education. And it's not all about cheating. We hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we'll look forward to seeing you again Monday, right here on Main Street.